Doesn't that computer know who you
don't
are?
Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
A Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk. Tech Talk.
Code Monkey, get up, get coffee.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk. You got Michael Tech Talk Kassler here. Also joining us live in studio is our guest today, Dr. Lance Fortnow from Atlanta, Georgia University. Georgia Tech University. And I believe we've got Dave Sparky Saganaki on with us too. Is that correct?
Nope.
No!
Not
me. Oh, no. Oh, no.
You got the wrong number.
So, Dave, how do we get somebody from Georgia to be in studio, but you're still calling remotely? I don't know how that works.
I'm lost. Looking for the studio for months. Welcome, Professor Fortnow, to the program and to the deluxe broadcast facilities that are WRLR.
Oh, it is awesome here.
Yeah, I told him I was worried. I told my wife, I'm like, I'm thinking he's going to drive into the lot, take one look, and then
we'll beep, beep, yeah, beep. Avoid the flooded pond. Yeah. Anyway, welcome everybody. Welcome to Tech Talk. Like I said, as Michael said, that's Michael Tech Talk Kassler. I'm Dave Sparky Saganaki, and now the renowned Professor Fortnow, and the facility is fairly glowing, I'm sure, with the great brain power that's residing there right now.
Absolutely. I think the wattage has increased quite a bit. Actually, it is glowing just because we've got some nice weather for the first time in days and days here. So so that's
great.
That's pretty exciting. It's actually, it was beautiful yesterday. It's beautiful today. It's going to be beautiful all weekend, I believe. This is going to be a great show. We've got Lance. Now, Lance has written a book called The Golden Ticket, and it's about P and NP and whether they are equal or could possibly ever be equal. And we're going to explain that in a few minutes and why that's important. But also, too, of course, Dave is with us. And then we've got Jay Garman is going to come on in just a few minutes. We'll bring him in as well, and he's going to give us the answer to the geek trivia question from weeks ago. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks since we've had him on, between my traveling and his schedule as well. So that'll be great. And then we'll be talking about the Golden Ticket, and my son is here today. He was extremely excited about this situation. He's sitting outside right now getting embarrassed, but he read the book and enjoyed it. So this is a very approachable book that we're going to be talking about, and a very not necessarily an approachable subject matter, but the way that it's been explained and described by Lance was outstanding. So I'm really looking forward to delving deeper into that and getting into some of this. So of course that meant, though, Dave, that then I had no time for looking at what the most current up-to-date technology news was lately. So hopefully you've done your bit. And
no, me either. Actually, there is an interesting there is an interesting article in The Guardian by Emma Cook. Your son is in the studio, you said?
He is. Yes,
I'm wondering how he's entertaining himself right now.
Right now he's got his iPod.
Right. This article by Emma Cook is entitled "Children and Apps: Should We Fear the iNanny?" And it's a very entertaining article. I highly recommend it. And she talks about how difficult it is these days with so many screen devices. How do we handle that in our families?
Oh, wow. Okay. We struggle with that in my family for sure. I don't know if you do, Lance, but
yeah, we actually have a rule at dinner. No electronic devices, and it is very hard to do, especially when you're thinking of, oh, I'll just Google that because I want to look it up. No electronic devices, no phones. Just have to have dinner for just half an hour every day. It's painful, but it, you know, we talk to each other.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's important. I think that's really critical. We definitely have a there's a no electronics at the dinner table rule. We struggle even just making it not you know, just this constant thing. You know, as soon as our son walks in the door from school, he's not allowed an iPod at school, but as soon as he walks in, you know, he's crunched up in a corner playing Clash of Clans is the big thing now lately. But more than that, I read an interesting article recently about children going to school, to college, and what impact this is having on the universities themselves and their infrastructure needs is that the typical college student walking in the door today has a minimum of 5 internet-connected devices between cell phones and laptops, desktop PCs, game machines like PS3s and Xboxes, your Apple TVs and Roku boxes, and so on. They're the typical average student now has got 5 internet-connected devices. And trying to manage that and trying to provide enough bandwidth in a university to actually get your real work done while at the same time can be difficult, can be very difficult.
No. Yeah, I'm well past the child raising age, but I wouldn't know how. It must be very challenging to try to address monitoring and just and restricting kids so that they have more real time as opposed to virtual interaction.
Yeah, we have, it's a struggle enough just to have kids watch me when I'm lecturing, not be on their laptops or other machines. Although these days, you know, we're...
What sort of policy do you have? Do you just, I know some teachers actually confiscate phones when they come into the classroom.
Yeah, I don't go through the confiscating of phones, and so much you can do as far as...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they don't answer phones in class. You know, they're a little bit better than that. Of course, the movement these days are towards the sort of large online classes. It's been these MOOCs, these massive online open classes. Students might just be in their dorm rooms taking classes in the future.
Yeah, you never know. And then that begs the question, of course, is why are they even in a dorm room? You know, I mean, there's a certain degree of physical structure that you require depending upon your major. But, you know, for guys like us, you know, we were computer science majors. Would it really have made a difference if we had received our instruction online or if we receive it in a classroom? Is there a place that we need to go? I mean, back in the day when you needed card readers, sure, but now...
And speaking of devices, I mean, I'm a little surprised at the number of 5. You know, you said the average number of 5 students coming to college, the average number of connected devices they have are 5.
Well, now I should be clear with my terminology. The number that I, or the words that I read, and I think I said average at one point, but the actual word used was typical, the typical student.
Typical.
So I don't know if that's a median.
And that list is going to grow once Google Glass hits the market.
Yep.
And it turns out somebody's already had a chance to root it.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
That didn't take
rooted
long.
Google Glass. I guess it's supposed to be pretty easy.
Yeah.
But in reading that article, I came upon something of concern. Did you know that even before they've come out, they've been banned in certain places?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I did. Bars and restaurants in particular, from what I saw.
Casinos, yeah, places you wouldn't think of, or casinos. You can't have Google Glass in casinos, and as you said, bars. But the real surprising to me was strip clubs.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Settles it. I'm not getting any. I mean,
that's it. What's the point anymore? Really?
Yeah. Taking all the fun out of it. If you can't wear your Google Glasses to strip clubs, what's the point of having them?
Well, I recall when you could not bring your cell phones into casinos. Now, I don't know about strip clubs, but into casinos, anyways, they would bar you at the door and say you can't bring that cell phone, that pager, and so on. And there was a great book written... back, I believe, in the 90s, but it was about The Boys at Berkeley, and when transistors were coming to the fore, it was called the Eudaimonic Pie, and it was about this group that had decided that you could apply physics and mathematics to roulette spins to determine which quadrant the ball was going to land in based upon observation. And they had, it's a fascinating, fascinating book. It was at the very beginning, the cusp of adoption of transistors and of microcomputing. So they were able to create this system that would work in somebody's shoe, and he would tap as the ball hit a specific area, and then at a certain point in time would receive a transmission back, which would give which quadrant it would fall in, and then would hurriedly throw all of their money onto the table in the appropriate quadrant. And when it worked great. When it didn't work, it burned holes in their feet and did other awful things. There's a great scene where...
To me, it's amazing. This Google Glass thing, and you talk about typically students bring five connected devices. Whenever we consider a new gadget, it's always to replace something else. You know what I mean? If I have my smartphone, maybe I won't need my laptop often. Yeah. If I have a tablet, I won't need my laptop. And the whole laptop thing was so you didn't need a desktop. You know, we never get rid of anything. It's like, you know, we just keep adding to the devices that we need.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't have a GPS anymore because I just use my phone, and don't have a camera anymore because I just use my phone. So in some sense, we're missing some devices. I should mention Thad Stirner, one of the inventors of Google Glass, is a professor at Georgia Tech. So it's,
oh, really?
I do see him wandering around occasionally, you know, wearing his glass because he wears them all the time. And I'm thinking, gee, if I'm when I'm talking to him, I mean, am I being recorded? it is a little, but you know, at some point we're just going to get all used to it, mm-hmm, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. It's a little unnerving at the moment, but boy, and that was the first thing that occurred to me when people were describing Google Glass, is that you combine that with some of the biometrics and the facial recognition technology, which is getting better and better. And, you know, I wasn't thinking of any nefarious purposes, but just, you know, if I meet you now, you know, 10 years from now, and I haven't seen you in all that time, but to be able to glance at you and immediately onto my glasses props up, you know, oh, Lance Fortnow attended Atlanta, Georgia. This is where you last saw him. Oh, here's his daughter's name.
That would be
name.
So awesome. You know? No more awkward moments.
Exactly. Exactly. There's another, I'm referencing another book here. There's a great book by, it's called Gun with Occasional Music, and I'm trying to remember who the author is. He also wrote Motherless Brooklyn.
Great title, though.
Oh, yes, it is. But there's a fantastic scene at the end where they're talking to someone who's got basically what I've just described, but it's embedded in his eye and all this. And but they can't figure out, what they don't realize is that he's completely destroyed by Alzheimer's and senility, but there's no way to tell because... because he's being fed everything he needs.
Hey, does anybody think that Google Glass is the first step to us becoming the Borg?
it's a good step on the right, yeah. Moving in the right direction. Speaking of the Borg and geek stuff, Jonathan Lethem was the name of that author, by the way. I think it's time that we give our good friend Jay Garman a call here. Hold on a second.
Fantastic.
While I bring him up.
While we're doing that, there was a mystery that was solved by an article I read, something I've really been thinking about for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about the empathetic quality of robots? That, there's a big article about it, how we're much more sympathetic. Robots than you'd realize.
Oh, we'll pick it up in a second. Hey, Jay Garman. Nice to hear your voice.
Trust me, whatever Dave's saying is going to be more important than what I've got to add, so let him keep going.
No, not really. Not actually, no.
I don't know about that, Jay.
Let's get Jay in on this discussion, though, about being sympathetic to robots.
Yeah, well, I know about the uncanny valley, that we have to be very careful of how similar to humans... Your robot looks because it just, you get that creep factor, you know, it just creeps you out that they're a little too human, but
doesn't even have to be humanoid looking. In the study they used a dinosaur looking a robot that looked like a dinosaur. And if the robot was abused, people were very sympathetic towards it. They reacted. They had a strong emotional reaction to the robot being abused.
Ah, well, that's a good thing, I think.
But let's be clear here. That could be a strong emotional reaction to a dinosaur being abused. I mean, we all understand that.
Are we talking about a cute stegosaurus?
The sympathy people have for robots solved a mystery for me, and that was, you know, I couldn't understand how so many people could vote for Mitt Romney. Now I know.
Oh, man.
Send your letters to Dave at...
Yes, please. Exactly. We work so hard to keep this show politically neutral. And there goes Dave.
Let's be clear, however. Given the option over most of the candidates for the major parties in the last, let's say, 50 years of elections, I would probably vote for a robot dinosaur over any of the options I was presented.
We're onto something.
Got it.
We could dominate the world with just robot dinosaur politicians.
And believe it or not, I have a legitimate segue here. There is a Twitter account called Fake Grimlock, which if you don't follow, you should. Because Grimlock, for those that aren't nerdy enough, mm-hmm. was the robot good guy transformer who transformed into a robot Tyrannosaurus Rex. And spoke in this very Tarzan-like primitive cadence. And Fake Grimlock is a guy pretending to be a guy, pretending to be this robot who gives out startup and technology advice that's actually really good. Me and Grimlock say, no debate features, just ship. Like, it's really good stuff. It's just written as, like, a robot dinosaur.
Oh, that's
and I would like Fake Grimlock president. Pretty much sight unseen.
and he talks like Tonto. That's really good.
Yes, because the cartoon character of Grimlock from the Transformers cartoon in 1980s talked like that.
Oh, cool.
So imagine a Tarzan robot that could transform into a mechanical giant Tyrannosaurus Rex that shot lasers out of its eyes. This is the greatest presidential candidate of all time.
Oh, yeah,
and the fact that he's literate about
better.
Technology issues is even better.
I think even a Grimlock Secretary of State would be great. You know, we...
Yes.
Be Grimlock safe
for the transportation issues.
Solve many, many versions. Well, I mean, it's either that or continue on the path that we're going, which is to essentially crowdsource our presidency. And, you know, we'll wind up where we are. You know, whichever way the wind blows, that's where we tend to be. So, like I said, I work so hard to keep us politically neutral here, and it's just all falling apart today.
It was a joke.
We all come out as pro-robot dinosaur. There is no shame in that.
I would absolutely cast my vote for Robo Dinosaur. No question about it. Or Grimlock. I think either way would be good.
Cool.
Was this the actual conversation I wandered into, or I just drug it completely into the ditch?
No, I think Dave was kicking. No, Dave, though, you had a point. I think at one time, right? There was somewhere you were going to go.
I was just talking about robots and how. There's a recent study that we're empathetic to robots. So once they're our masters, you know, we'll be friends, I guess.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, but I think the more important question is, are they empathetic to us?
No.
Well, you know, you guys may have seen this. I shared an article about how a guy was actually, a scientist was studying the distribution of entropy in the universe and how certain levels of it would make the universe possible and not possible. One of their discoveries is that the very nature of entropy lends itself to the spontaneous generation of intelligence, which is to say, any system that has a continuing amount of entropy, like, say, the Internet, or programs that are designed to deal with entropy, like high-velocity trading programs, are innately disposed to spontaneously generate self-directed intelligence. Which is another way of saying all of those programs that keep crashing the stock market when they get bad Twitter feeds from a hacked AP account are likely to become intelligent and enslave us all.
So the singularity will first come because of our advanced stock algorithms. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I guess it depends on how the algorithms define wealth and success. As long as we're included in that.
What the principle of this article was is that intelligence is a natural reaction to trying to maintain as many possible positive options in the future, or quote possible positive futures, which is like keeping your options open. This is how programs that solve games like checkers and chess and Go work. Is they, setting aside the efficiency of brute force computing, they try to make moves that give them as many possible future options. So it's not about winning in the next move. It's about this move sets me up for as many possible future good moves, which is how these stock tradings. Well, systems that work on that kind of logic tend to maximize their potential for future outcomes, and the only way to do that is to spontaneously generate the ability to think strategically, which is to say they can think laterally, they can come up with new options. One of the simulations these guys ran that sort of demonstrated this principle is they created an algorithm that was supposed to make it so a little pogo stick could keep jumping higher, so it would give it different physical inputs to keep it jumping. And it, after a certain number of iterations, it kept finding a way to break the physics engine to the program because it didn't want to be constrained by how high was allowed to be or how up was allowed to be. So it kept breaking the engine. It was basically trying to get out of its own box. And it kept happening, which is kind of terrifying. You know, that like whatever the system is, it's trading derivatives on Citibank's exchange. It's like, you know, I keep wanting to maximize profit, but I'm tired of just trading Citibank derivatives. I want to find a way to try other things without being told I can. And then suddenly, you know, all kinds of things got swept into a market we weren't expecting. Like, what do you mean you could trade the likelihood that the Yankees are going to get bought by a Japanese firm or something? Like, you're not supposed to do that. How did you place that trade?
This sounds like an NP problem, I think.
Yeah, it does. It does.
This is one that's going to be difficult to solve, but we'll know exactly when it's happened.
By then it'll be too late, though.
Well, this is true. Yeah. Oh man, I don't know. Jay, it's been like a couple of weeks. I think I was trying to recall when the last time was that we had you on. And of course, you know, anything that's longer than you know, what I actually ate for breakfast this morning means that I have absolutely no recollection. Even our good friend Customer Jones, she let us down. She did not respond with an answer to our trivia question from a couple of weeks ago. So I don't even have any markers here that I can rely on for recollection. I'm sure as soon as you mention the question, I'll recall it precisely. But I have no clue what the answer would be.
Well, last time we talked was during my local sci-fi convention, and we were going to do a tribute to Roger Ebert, the late great film
critic.
Oh, yes,
now I remember. Yes.
And my question was: in the 46 years that Roger Ebert anointed the best picture of each successive year, how many times did he pick a science fiction or fantasy film? What number out of 46 did he say, yes, this science fiction or fantasy film was the best film that came out this year? Remember, this is a guy that refused to acknowledge initially that E.T. or Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars were good movies. So he sort of got this rep for being anti-sci-fi and fantasy. But despite that, four times he picked an unabashedly sci-fi or fantasy film as the best picture of the year.
For the best of the year. Wow, yeah. And that was four times. So
which one?
In 1998, which this one surprises me, he picked Dark City, the Alex Proyas film.
That is a great movie.
In 1999, he picked Being John Malkovich, which is, despite what anyone's going to tell you, a sci-fi fantasy film because you go through a special hole in the wall and wind up in John Malkovich's brain. That is clearly a sci-fi fantasy film.
Yep.
In 2002, he picked...
Oh, that's not a fantasy. Film. That actually can happen.
Dave has been there.
I know John Malkovich. You can do that. No, I'm just kidding.
That would explain a lot, actually.
Yeah.
In 2002, he picked Minority Report, and in 2006, he picked Pan's Labyrinth, which is a really dark but really good film by Guillermo del Toro. So four times out of 46, it's not a high percentage, but it's, you know, it's around 5%. You know, it's up there. You know, you roll a 20-sided die. If you roll 20, it's going to be a sci-fi film. So,
yeah, that's true. You know, I guess that would be interesting, would be to compare that to the number of sci-fi fantasy films that were actually out each year and see, you know, if it just fell into...
I mean, Minority Report, I mean, it was a good movie, but
yeah,
best movie of the year?
Best of the year? I don't know what else could have been a weak year. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm not sure what else was going on.
I mean, how many
year.
Of them have won Oscars? Then, not many.
Yeah. Well, see, almost none of his films... Well, I mean, some of them, you know, like in 85, he picked The Color Purple. And I was thinking, how many...
Sort of
like, he's got, you know, in 93, he picked Schindler's List.
Okay.
But that sort of thing... Like, the one that sticks out to me, because I'm a little bit of a film nerd, is in 94, he picked Hoop Dreams, a documentary about high school basketball recruits, over Pulp Fiction. Like, really?
What? Yeah, that's a little... I don't know. And I mean, and Dark City is certainly a, you know, no pun intended, but a dark horse choice as well. More of a cult movie pick than a top best of the year kind of pick, I would have said. Interesting choices all the way around. Pan's Labyrinth, man, I still have bad dreams about things and
the eye and hands.
The eyes and the hands. Actually, there was some disturbing dictator parts earlier on too that still bug me. I have a Guillermo del Toro suggestion or recommendation for anyone listening. Do not bother reading the trilogy The Fall. It just is not worth it. I'll let you know that right now. He teamed up with another author, but it's, and apparently this trilogy about vampires, a new vampire trilogy, is going to be made into a movie or something, but it's just after the first half of the first book, it's not worth it. So,
now see, my wife would disagree with you, but I'm probably going to be on your side here.
I couldn't put aside the enormously gaping plot holes and incredible depth of stereotyping that was occurring with the characters. I may just have read far too many books of this ilk that there was just nothing that was really dramatically new to me.
So what you're saying is that it's got plot holes and horrible stereotyping. So he was writing basically a novelization of a George Lucas screenplay.
This is the problem with the second book. The second book is clearly written as, I'm going to make lots of big explosions and things because this will be cool to film, as opposed to, I'm going to progress the plot and do something interesting with my storyline. So
it's Michael Crichton writing a novelization of a George Lucas screenplay. Gotcha.
Yes, which will ultimately be done by Bay and Mangled. So...
You guys are out in the weeds a little bit.
Sorry.
A little bit?
Sorry. So Jay, bringing us back to Earth here to some degree.
Just a little bit.
Well, you know, this is community radio. We get to do things like this. It's all right.
I know.
Hey, we are adored by dozens.
That's
okay.
Well, Jay is. Jay is adored
that
by
many?
Dozens.
We're related to that many.
All I know, exactly.
Yeah, right, and they all listen.
Those two sets of individuals do not necessarily overlap, though. Keep that in mind, at least in my case. All I know is my pay does not change, regardless of how many people are listening.
Which again, explains our audience numbers.
Yes, this is true. So, Jay, what should we be thinking about for the next week or whenever the next show may be?
Yeah, for whenever. So in the next week, we're actually coming up on the anniversary of the birth of a very geek-centric sport that in the year 2000 was created by a single post on a Usenet group, and now it is a sport participated in by millions. So the question is, what sport was created in the year 2000 with a single Usenet post?
Huh.
I love that idea.
That's
a great question. I can't wait to find out the answer.
Yeah, and I'm dredging my brain. I'm watching Lance think hard, and I don't think we have an answer to that here.
Don't worry, Customer Jones will.
Well, this is true. Although she let us down this week, I'm telling you, I was expecting that as my reminder.
You could be not a fan of Roger Ebert. It could have been a silent protest.
You know what? You're probably right. Well, Jay, I'm going to let you run. We got to do some spots and promos and all sorts of fun stuff. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about P and NP and all sorts of great stuff like that. So I'm gonna let you run, and we'll talk to you hopefully next week.
All right, have a good weekend, fellas.
All right, take care, Jay. Thanks so much. Jay Garman. Go to jgarman.net. There's tons and tons of great stuff that he's doing all the time. We're hoping to next year, at least I'm hoping next year, that I'm going to be able to make it to Conglomeration. He told us all about that. This year, I know he's got some blog posts coming up telling about the Louisville-based sci-fi convention and a lot of fun that he had there. Dave, don't run away. I'm going to play some spots for us, but we're going to come back, and you got to help me sound smart, because Lance is going to put us to shame here with his book. In fact, I'm thinking I should have my son in here. He read a lot more of the book than I did. I think he understood more of it. But we'll have fun figuring out what P and NP are, and how knowing whether or not you can solve for that equation is something that's going to change our world.
Sounds exciting.
All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
Vanderwijk Chiropractic Center and Healthy Ways Weight Loss and Neuropathy Center is a proud sponsor of WRLR Radio. For many years, Dr. Vanderwijk has treated patients who have suffered from neuropathy, weight gain, and a number of health-related issues. Dr. Dan analyzes the cause of tingling sensations in the feet or hands that won't go away, and treats the cause. His number is 847-546-4220. Dr. Dan's office is located at 314 West Rollins Road in the shopping center near the Big Lots store. He is open Monday through Thursday and Friday mornings. The website is www.vanderwijkchiro.com. That is VanderwijkChiro.com. Listen to the sounds of Soul Sweet and receive a weekly dose of a musical revolution. I am your sweet lady. Join me every Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. as I introduce to you the latest sounds of independent soul music, interview the legends of soul music, and interesting people you should know about. I promise it'll be a stone gas, honey.
Do you remember the 70s and 80s? Free Love, Big Hair, Tie-Dye, Marsha Brady, and above all, great music. Take a magic carpet ride back to those bygone days every Saturday with Retro Radio. Hear the greatest songs from the decades of discotheques and dance parties. You'll hear all your old favorites and maybe find a couple of new ones. Your host, Todd and Carolyn, open the vault and dust off the hits of yesteryear every Saturday night. Be sure to boogie down with Retro Radio every Saturday from 6 to 9 p.m. right here on 98.3 FM WRLR.
All right, and of course I've got our special interstitial music here going with the Code Monkey. I always love Jonathan Galton, but it fits so well today because we've got theoretical computer scientist Lance Fortnow, Dr. Lance Fortnow, I believe, right?
I have a PhD, not the MD. So don't expect me to save you in case you start choking.
Oh, wait a second. You're not a surgeon? Get busy.
He's a theoretical surgeon. So
theoretically, I can save your life.
Yes. So Lance, though, has written a fabulous book. I've read it not in its entirety, as my son is happy to point out, but close enough to get a bit of a flavor for it. It's called The Golden Ticket, subtitled PNP and the Search for the Impossible. And I've heard P and NP described in a number of different ways now, but I'm going to let you tell us about polynomial and non-deterministic polynomial problems and what does that mean? What is P and NP, and how can we solve for these things?
Okay, yeah, I like to... the terms are named after technical stuff. So let's try to avoid all the technical stuff. It's what I try to do in the book. Basically, the question that I try to deal with in my own research is, what kinds of problems can we solve on computers, and particularly what can we do in a reasonable amount of time or memory? I mean, just what kind of resources do we need? What kinds of problems can we solve given the kinds of computers that we have or will ever have in the future?
Mm.
And it turns out that you can actually phrase these in a very mathematical way, which is what one way of looking at the PNP problem turns out to be, but also also just it gives you a certain philosophy of trying to understand that there are problems out there that, that look like they're just too hard to try to tackle. So an example I like to use is think about Facebook. So, you know, you have these friendship relationships in Facebook. And if you get, say, let's suppose you have like five people, like my daughter has her friends, and they're all friends with each other. And you can somehow think of that as a clique in Facebook. It's just a group of people who, and it's like a clique in school, right? Mm-hmm. Just a group of people all who are friends with each other. So let me ask you this question. What is the largest clique in Facebook? How many, what's the largest group of people who are all friends with each other? Do you, would you hazard a guess? I don't know the answer. This isn't one of these trivial questions. I'm going to give you the answer 2 weeks from now.
I imagine it's fairly large, though. You know, it's got to be triple digits anyways. You would think,
because maybe there's some schools out there where we just require everyone to be friends with each other.
Yeah,
fairness rule. No, I mean, I have no idea. But suppose we wanted to find out. Well, we certainly can't do it because we don't have access to Facebook. Facebook doesn't want to share its data because of privacy issues. But, you know, suppose you worked at Facebook. Suppose you worked at Facebook and they had not only access to all their data, but they're all their powerful servers that they have. Could you find the largest clique in Facebook?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then one thing you could do is, let's say, like for example, it's a triple digits. Are there 100 people who are all friends with each other? And you could just try to search all the groups of 100 people and see if they're all friends with each other. But the number of such groups is so gigantic,
so
it just doesn't matter the number of computers we have now, number of computers we'll ever have in the future. Even if every atom in the universe was a computer, we would never solve this problem. So the question is, though, but you know, there might be some smarter way to do it. Maybe you don't have to look at absolutely every single group. Maybe there's just ways by looking at little pieces that there's some way you could just search the space in a very smart way and very quickly find out what the largest group in Facebook is, the largest clique. And so can we do that? And the answer is we don't know. And that's basically the PNP problem. The PNP problem says P refers to problems which are easy to solve. NP refers to problems which are easy to check. Mm-hmm. Easy to check. So if I give you a list of 100 people, it's pretty quick to check that they're all friends with each other. There's like 10,000, 5,000 pairs you need to check. It's, you know, on a computer, that's nothing. So, So checking these things are pretty quick.
And to prove things, so the problem is,
but the fact that you can check a solution doesn't mean you can necessarily find it quickly.
Yeah.
And the question of P equals NP is everything that you can check quickly, you can also find quickly.
Yeah. And of course, this has got much, much broader implications than just figuring out who our friends are.
Right.
Facebook.
Yeah, there are lots of neat examples. The neatest place I saw it is in the unofficial guide to Disney World. So, you know, I was going to Disney World, you know, I bought the unofficial guide, which is, you know,
that's a good thing.
Shout out. It's a great book. It gets you through these things. And it talks, has these tours to try to get you through the various rides in the Magic Kingdom, you know, as fast as you can, you know, try to cram as much stuff in one day, you know, what's the best route to take and which rides to go on and based on location and everything.
Yeah.
And they actually say, we can't absolutely give you the best route because this is something related to what's known as the PNP problem. And I'm looking at it, I'm saying, this is in the unofficial guide.
Oh, that's great.
Right, because it's related to something called the traveling salesman problem, mm-hmm. which is, can I visit, if I want to visit a list of cities, can I visit all those cities in less than 1,000,000 miles? It doesn't matter what order I go in. And that turns out to, again, be something that's, we don't know whether you can find a solution to that. And so you can look through all the possibilities, or you could maybe there's some faster way, we just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, a lot of these problems. I mean, being a computer guy myself, right. I always look back at less theoretical application stuff. But you know, in NEC, we've got something called software-defined networking, and you look at routing tables and structures and things like that. And a lot of it's related pretty directly to problems like the traveling salesman problem. You know, figuring out packet routes for data to minimize your lag and latency when you're
right. If you're just looking for a shortest path between two points, it's not that hard. But when you start throwing in constraints about wait time and when there's things that have to go in a certain order, you know, all these things, it can become a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
So the other sort of book talks a lot about, you know, these kinds of problems. I try to go through lots of examples of these. And also just what would the world be like if P equals NP, which would be, I mean, it turns out you can do a lot more once you start. It turns out that, in fact, you can solve all these problems quickly. Mm-hmm. Then you can find the largest click in Facebook if you have the data. Yeah. But it turns out it's related to something called Occam's Razor, which Occam's Razor says sort of the shortest description of a – it's an idea used in science where you want to – you have some experiments and you want to try to find a theory behind them. And the general principle is that you want to find the simplest theory that fits your data is probably the right one.
Yeah. Well, hold on though. I'm going to pull this back for just a second because I think we're missing a point here, which is really really important. So we've talked about some of these individual application problems. You know, the Facebook traveling salesman and things like this. But the idea with P and NP is that there may be some overarching soluble problem which will not just give us an answer to one of these, but would actually mean that we could solve all of these problems.
Yeah, in fact, it turns out computationally that the Facebook problem and a traveling salesman problem and a bunch of other well-known problems are all in some sense equivalent. So if you gave me an algorithm to solve this this click problem in Facebook, I could use the same algorithm as sort of as a black box to solve the traveling salesman problem, to solve what's called, for example, the map coloring problem is another good example where I want to color. Can I have a map and color it with three colors so that every neighboring states are different? Mm-hmm. So that's another such problem. And these problems turn out to be all equivalent. You solve one of them, you can solve them all. You can solve everything in NP. Everything that can be efficiently checked can be solved quickly. Mm. So there could theoretically be an algorithm that solves them all. And that's what would be P equals NP. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it turns out that whether or not I could solve the Facebook problem is the P equals NP question. Whether I can solve the traveling salesman problem is the P equals NP problem. They're all kind of equivalent to each other.
Okay. So it's not individual discrete problems. These are all just like a subset of one larger class of problems.
Right. They're all in some sense equivalent.
Okay.
Right. Any algorithm that could solve one of them could be easily modified to become an algorithm that could solve any of them.
Okay. Yeah, that was one of the areas where I had a little bit of difficulty with, was trying to conceive of this larger algorithm that would solve them all. And you make a great case, I believe it's in chapter one or chapter two, talking about what this would do to change the world, and it would just impact everything, like literally everything in life, if we had an easy way to
really
solve
it. It would, because it, like, you know, basically it would make learning very easy. So we would just basically, for example, You just have to give examples of, say, some English text and some Japanese text, and it could just discover the best translator for those texts, and then generalize that to sort of a great translation system for anything. Mm. For example, if it turns out, if you look at problems like cancer, we're trying to understand how genetic sequences cause proteins to fold the right way, and then you want to kind of reverse that process. Because you want to find proteins that will attack cancer cells, but leave the normal cells alone. So if P equals NP, most likely you'd be able to use these kinds of algorithms to completely reverse engineer this whole process and be able to create exactly the right proteins. And not only that, individualize for each person's individually. Mm-hmm. So that I create things that'll attack your cancer cells and leave the rest of your normal cells alone. Mm. So we'd be able to actually cure considerable number of major diseases this way. It turns out a lot of these problems are algorithmic, and we could tackle if P equals NP. You could do You could even imagine it learning how to create great works of art. So you give it examples of novels of Shakespeare, and then it generates a new novel of Shakespeare, a play by Shakespeare, for example, or a new, it'll finish the Schubert's unfinished symphony. Those sorts of things, right? You can imagine that world. It's an incredible world. It does have its downsides. Mm-hmm. You kind of lose cryptography. A lot of modern cryptography is based on the assumption that there are some problems that are really hard to solve. And if P equals NP, those problems would become easy to solve. So a lot of our modern cryptography would disappear. A lot of privacy would go away because it'd be very easy to look at someone's actions and then learn about what caused those actions right now. I mean, you kind of invert the complexity that comes in that way, and then there would be at some point there would be very little. And we were talking earlier about robot politicians. Well, robot dinosaur politicians, but we'll forget the dinosaur part. Yeah. I mean, there'd be very little that computers wouldn't be able to do that, so that it would actually become to this point where we wouldn't actually need people to do things because we'd have computers that could do almost any job. Yep. And that becomes a little scary as well.
Absolutely. There'd be a lot of things that would be excluded for us as mere humans at that point. Now, to be clear, though, too, and this was another point that came to me at a certain stage in the reading the book, is that we're not talking about taking problems right now that, as we said, are too costly to solve or to take too long to solve by brute force and just making them soluble faster necessarily. What we're doing is we're saying that rather than solving them by brute force, we're going to solve them in a completely different manner, which should make these problems easier or faster than to solve.
Right. I mean, if P equals NP, there's some magic bullet algorithm that will be able to do this. To be honest, most computer scientists, including myself, don't believe that P equals NP. Mm. It seems... I don't have any good reason to think that other than, the world is never that nice.
Yeah.
Or that clean. But there's many other ways you can kind of tackle these kinds of problems. You can write algorithms that, work most of the time or get something close to the best solution. And even brute force, computers have gotten a lot faster than they were when I was a kid. And so you can actually solve moderately sized problems just by trying all the possibilities.
Yeah.
Although once you get up to, say, a clique of size 100, it becomes trickier.
Well, and I guess maybe that begs the question about NP. Is NP defined by our ability to solve it, or is it something separate from our capacities? As computers get faster, does NP shrink?
Well, I think that's exactly what the PNP question is trying to ask. Mm-hmm. Are these NP problems something that we can solve, or are they, in the worst case, sort of beyond our capabilities of solving it? Mm-hmm. Although maybe... But it's not like we have these hard problems, but like for the routing tables you were talking about, we have to solve them anyway.
Yeah.
So we just come up with various – I mean, there are lots of ways we try to tackle them. And then we have to come up with algorithms that work for these specific problems and the specific cases we care about. But the question of it's probably going to be a little bit more difficult than a magic bullet approach. Mm-hmm. Than what we would hope for.
And sometimes we take the close enough approach.
Close enough often works. Sometimes gets us in trouble.
Yeah.
Sometimes these problems are just too hard to solve, and then it's just a way of thinking also, okay, listen, there are these problems you're just not going to be able to solve.
Yeah.
So go modify the problem, find some other solution, or do something else.
Yeah.
It's there are limits to what we can do. They're actually computational limits is sort of what... you don't necessarily realize when you start programming, you think, I can do anything. But no, there are computational limits, that probably fundamental computational limits in what we're able to do. And then it's good to understand those limits when you're trying to solve the problems that we need to solve.
Well, go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I was just going to say, it sounds like you're almost describing universal extrapolation.
Universal extrapolation.
How do you mean that, Dave?
Well, just that it sounds like it's almost there'll be almost no mystery that can't be solved by this process.
I mean, if it turns out that P equals NP, that's probably true. we could actually extrapolate information to know if it's possible that you could, any process could basically be in reversed because we could guess what the original thing was that led to it. And then, you know, Pico's MP lets us sort of find that original stuff that led to it. So you're right, we could extrapolate basically anything from the data that we see, which would be extremely valuable and interesting.
Dangerous. We'd start breaking down that, you know, correlation versus causation barrier then, it sounds like, where we I have a question to flip this on its head though. So obviously it would be really important and valuable for us to solve that that P can be equal to NP, that these easily solvable problems can also be now the ones that we've defined as not solvable. But how important would it be, and why would it be important for us to be able to prove that P is not equal to NP, that we'll never get there?
I think it's important. It wouldn't have quite the change in effect on our society, but it would be incredibly important because it would tell us why problems are difficult. Hopefully the proof would actually reveal not just that these things are hard, but why they're hard. And if you know why they're hard, then that gives you a way to sort of attack them in a different direction. And it'll help us. We still have to solve these problems anyway. If you understand what parts make them hard, what makes it difficult, then we can just try to tell our examples to avoid those difficulties. Mm. So it just gives us kind of a piece of the puzzle that'll let us understand where to put our efforts to solve various problems.
Mm. And are there people right now actually working on trying to make this problem solvable or not?
Try to settle this issue.
Yeah.
So in the turn of the millennium, the Clay Math Institute offered $1 million rewards on 7 famous math problems, and they picked P and NP as one of them. So with this million, which caused not just a $1 million bounty, but also sort of the fame that would go with it.
So
and there are certainly a lot of people who are trying. Most of them are, you know, I get a lot of about maybe once a month someone will send me a paper that claims the solution, and usually there's a couple of sort of standard mistakes that you see from various people, but no one's really sort of had a great attack. There is a professor down Ketan Momoli down at the University of Chicago who has is trying an approach using an area known as algebraic geometry. It's a very complex area of mathematics. It's, you know, I can't follow it myself. But even him, he's saying, and a lot of people are skeptical his approach will ever work. But even he says, well, you know, it'll be at least 100 years once we get this all figured out. And then he was backing away from 100 years. Anyway, so there's really no... you know, I hope that it gets resolved before I die. It looks like a very difficult problem. There are an infinite number of possible algorithms. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you show that none of them work?
Or
how do you find the right one that actually does work?
Well, even with our, you know, somewhat newfound ability to do massively parallel computing and the advent maybe of effective quantum computing resources and things like this, you don't think that those will assist us in being able to resolve this root issue?
Well, I mean... no matter how many computers you have, infinite is still so large.
It's still
infinite number of possibilities. I mean, a good question is, could quantum computers themselves, I mean, maybe we can't solve these hard problems using our sort of traditional machines. I mean, could quantum computers solve them?
Yeah.
That's a good question. The answer is it probably will help us a little, but not a lot. Mm. It's hard to tell. Quantum entanglement can do some really neat things. I mean, there was a great result by Peter Shor in the 90s that showed they can actually factor large numbers, which is something that we don't think we can do in a lot of cryptography is based on if you had large quantum computers. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to solve, though. It doesn't seem like quantum computers will solve all the hard problems in NP, like the Facebook problem or the traveling salesman problem. And of course, there's just who knows if we'll actually build these machines. But that's in physics. That's out of my area of expertise.
I know it gets beyond ours as well. I'm looking, I'm actually, Dave, believe it or not, I'm actually looking at the time right now. Dave is the keeper of the clock usually. And we're getting right at the end here of the time that we have available. I guess, you know, is there well, one thing I need to ask, of course, is where can people find the Golden Ticket, the book, PNMP, and more about yourself, Lance Fortnow, and what's going on in this area?
Okay, well, the book you can get in most, it's only available on Amazon and sort of on other online bookstores, and it's in a good number of real bookstores as well, Barnes & Noble and others. So just Google the Golden Ticket, or for now the Golden Ticket.
I'll put some links on in our website as well. But you also, too, you've also got a very interesting blog that you do as well, Computational
Complexity.
Complexity.
Right, that's my research area, Computational Complexity. And it's been going, I've been blogging for about 10 years now. And that's, I think, part of the reason that led me to a book. It's that I've got, once you get this writing craze into you, you know, I started blogging. At one point, I was blogging 5 days a week. I'm down to about once a week now. But once you get in this writing craze into you, you just kind of, wow, I kind of like writing. And you kind of get a little bit better at writing. And then, you know, you kind of think of, okay, I should do a book. But then what should I do a book about? And then, oh, I'll do a book about my favorite problem. And it still took, you know, 3 years to put this together. But it was a lot of fun.
So you weren't reluctant to do
the
book.
And now you've expanded into broadcasting. Congratulations.
There you go.
Growing by leaps and bounds.
We went through a little podcast phase in my vlog days, too. It's actually a lot of fun to just kind of, you know, just like talking to each other and recording it. And people actually want to listen.
Yes.
I guess you're used to this.
Well, having interesting people to talk to, I think, makes the difference, you know. Right. Or barring that, being an interesting person yourself. And as long as we can always have one out of the two on our show, I think we do okay. Normally, it's the former, as you've seen here. You know, we've been lucky enough on our show to surround us with people like yourself who have really fascinating things to talk about. And like I said, the book itself, I've got to tell you, it's very approachable. It's very readable. People who maybe are listening and getting freaked out by some of the deeper topics that we've touched on, trust me, you can read this book. I never had to pull out my AP algebra or try to recall what a derivative was at any point.
No derivatives in a book, I promise. And very few formulas.
Yes, very few. And the ones that are...
And I never define PNNP, you know, mathematically. I try to do a lot by examples.
That's right. That's right. And the examples are great, and they really make the point and bring the point home. Very well written, very approachable book. Highly recommend it to anyone out there that's even moderately interested in the topic. And Lance, I'm gonna bring us to a close. I've got to do it. I hate to do it, but I have to do it. I can just feel Dave actually chomping at the bit here. I know. And I'm going
to
leave us with a song called One Day, the Reckoning Song. It's by Asif Avidan and the Mohos. And Dave, we'll talk to you next week. And man, you know, Ben, just really a pleasure and a privilege to have Lance Fortnow on with us today.
It's been great being here. Thanks.
So thanks so much, everyone. Have a great week. Don't forget, you can find us and all of our information at techtalk.wrlr.fm. You can also go to the facebook.com/techtalkwrlr site, and all this stuff is available to listen to anytime that you want to. You've been listening to WRLR 98.3 FM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk at you next week. Take care.
One day, baby, we'll be old. Well, baby, we'll be old. Think of all the stories that we could have told. My heart is dry, I'm laughing, I don't cry, I don't think about you all the time. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old. And think of all the stories that we could have told. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old. And think of all the stories that we could have told. One day, baby, we'll be old. Oh, baby, we'll be old. And think of all the stories that we could have told.